ultimately, there'll be a resolution to this case. I don't know if I'll be alive to see it.
A new twist in the Exxon Valdez case. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 12th of August. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Bethel residents express disbelief over their latest electricity bills.
$3,562.86. And I was very shocked by that.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the State of Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Information about the state's predator management program is available on the web at wildlife.alaska.gov. APRN will be providing special coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood. For sponsorship information, call 550-8400.
The U.S. Supreme Court today declined to rule on the issue of whether plaintiffs in the Exxon Valdez oil spill case should receive interest on top of their already reduced punitive damages from the 1989 spill that fouled thousands of miles of Alaska's coastline from Prince William Sound to Kodiak and beyond. KMXT's Casey Kelly has more.
The court decided without prejudice to send the issue back to the Ninth Circuit Court to decide. Andrew Ott is a plaintiff's attorney with Jamin Schmidt St. John in Kodiak. He says the decision by the high court was not unexpected.
The interest issue is, at this stage, a matter of first impression for the Supreme Court, and they're not going to decide something on first impression unless, as the rules say, that they were to ones to put a monetary amount out there for recovery as a first instance. So if the court had trickled all the way through from the district court to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to the Supreme Court without any money damages, and they then instituted money damages, they then can decide the interest issue on first impression.
The Supreme Court ruled in June that punitive damages should be no greater than compensatory damages, which plaintiffs have already received. That works out to be about $507.5 million, one-tenth of the original jury award in 1994. Plaintiffs had been seeking an interest rate of 5.9% from September 24, 1996, which would have added an additional $488 million onto the award. Ott says he expects the Ninth Circuit Court to add the interest. Unfortunately, that opens up the possibility of more appeals by Exxon.
The Supreme Court could review what the Ninth Circuit does. So that means Exxon or us could petition the Supreme Court to review it. Whether or not Exxon's going to do that, who knows?
Ott says it's frustrating considering that the case has lingered in the courts for nearly two decades already.
You know, we would all like to see this thing come to an end. But I think, again, because of the rules written in with the Supreme Court couldn't deal with the issue at first hand, so it did have to bounce back to the Ninth Circuit.
For Stosh Anderson, a fisherman and plaintiff in the case, the Supreme Court's action means more uncertainty.
Well, it appears that the Supreme Court just ducked the question, and it's going to end up back in their case. So, I'm certainly no attorney or have legal experience, but this looks like just in the benefit of industry to drag this on so they don't have to pay.
Anderson says the spill continues to impact thousands of lives in coastal Alaska, and it's hard to see a resolution coming to the case anytime soon.
Many of the plaintiffs are passing away, and people's business plans are either rightfully or wrongfully, if the people have depended or at least anticipated distribution from this lawsuit, and that's not going to happen, and some people have trouble just moving on. Ultimately, there'll be a resolution to this case. I don't know if I'll be alive to see it.
The Ninth Circuit Court, based in San Francisco, decided in 2006 that Exxon should have to pay $2.5 billion in punitive damages. Ott says the court's decision in the interest case could be issued in as soon as 30 days. In Kodiak, I'm Casey Kelly.
Bethel residents and local businesses are in shock at the increase in their electric bills this month. Most have doubled, and some have even gone higher. With gas prices at $6 a gallon, residents are fearing for their futures. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning-Barnes reports.
When Bethel resident Teresa Nick first saw her electric bill this month, she didn't quite understand what she was seeing. The single mother of six owes over $400 instead of the expected $100 like she paid last month.
I thought they made a mistake. I called them in Anchorage, and that was my bill.
And that's for July, when Nick's home uses much less lighting and heating than in the wintertime.
So if it's $400 now, and winter is here, it'll probably be $8 to $1,000. There goes my paycheck. You know, I'm a single parent, and I have six kids to support, and how am I going to support my family?
Nick isn't the only one in town wondering what happened with this month's Bethel Utility Corporation electric bills. Most people say theirs doubled.
$3,562.86. And I was very shocked by that.
Michelle DeWitt is the director of the nonprofit 24-hour emergency shelter, Tender Women's Coalition in Bethel. It's a safe house for families dealing with violence and abuse. DeWitt's first reaction to the electric bill was to ask her staff what was happening.
The question of what have we done to generate a bill this high? And I started asking the staff if we had been using power in some way that we normally don't to warrant such a high bill.
Well, the recent increase is related to a specific charge on Bethel Utilities or BUC's electric bill. It's called the Cost of Power Adjustment, or COPA for short. Basically, COPA is related to the cost of fuel that the electric company needs to run its fuel-powered plant. Because BUC is paying more for that fuel, they're charging more for their electricity. This fuel rate gets adjusted every quarter, and BUC had not adjusted it since April. This new bill reflects the fuel increase that happened later on when the spring fuel barge arrived in Bethel. Tom Sterrett is BUC's controller.
The fuel price from our supplier went up by $2 a gallon from what we had frozen in place for the winter from last fall.
The fuel rate went from about 18 to 36 cents per kilowatt hour, which is a 93% increase. The Regulatory Commission of Alaska still must approve this increase, even though it already went into effect. If it's not approved, BUC will have to reimburse customers. RCA does not have to notify the public of the rate increase. However, they did post it on their website. Sterrett said Bethel Utilities did not warn customers of the change either.
No, we had nothing concrete that we could specifically give them until it hits the bill.
Meanwhile, Bethel resident Chip Hagedorn is still in shock. His electric bill jumped from $150 in July to $336 in August. He lives with his wife and one child and says his house is small and pretty airtight.
I was gone for a couple weeks this past month, and yet our bill had almost more than doubled. So we were quite surprised. We checked the electric meter to make sure it hadn't been misread, and it was read correctly. So we're getting pretty scared with winter coming on.
Professionally, Hagedorn is the president of the local union that represents teachers in the lower Kuskokwim Delta. He says teachers in Bethel do not get subsidized housing, and they often live together to make ends meet.
They're not going to be able to eat this increase and survive here. I'm sitting here, I've got about probably 85 teachers, first and second year teachers, that are real close to the bottom of the pay scale. They have no idea what they're walking into.
The city of Bethel was also taken off guard by this month's bill. Bethel's finance director, Lori Walters, is in her office figuring it out.
What I was just calculating was the anticipated increase to the city's annual budget for electricity. The 20% increase that's budgeted for FY09 is certainly not going to be adequate.
Walter says they might need to increase the budget for the city's electricity by $200,000 to meet the increase. The current COPA rate will not change for at least another two billing cycles. BUC's Sterrett says the price of diesel fuel in Bethel will determine what happens after that.
This is just something that is unavoidable given the structure of the COPA rate. And it's just our hope that at some point down the road that can change.
In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, some big names are already signed up for next year's Yukon Quest.
He may well be the first Iditarod champion to be a Yukon Quest rookie.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, focused on the future, getting more oil out of Prudhoe Bay and bringing Alaska's gas online. And by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
The prosecutors in the case against Senator Ted Stevens say his trial should not be moved to Alaska. In documents filed yesterday in U.S. District Court, the government made its case to keep the trial in Washington, D.C. Alaska senior senator faces 7 felony counts of lying on his financial disclosure statements about gifts he allegedly received from oil services company Vico. From Washington, D.C., APRN's Libby Casey reports.
Government prosecutors say Senator Stevens' trial should stay in Washington and that his reelection campaign is, in fact, a strong reason not to move the trial to Alaska. Stevens' lawyers filed a motion last week requesting that the case be moved. They say the D.C. location won't allow Stevens to effectively campaign to keep his Senate seat. The trial is scheduled to start in late September, right in the middle of the fall election season. Stevens' lawyers also say moving the trial to Alaska makes sense, because most of the witnesses are there, as is Stevens' Girdwood home, which is evidence in the case. But yesterday, the prosecutors argued that Stevens' reelection campaign is a prime reason not to transfer the trial to Alaska. They note that since Stevens returned to the state early this month, he's vocally proclaimed his innocence at campaign rallies, and prosecutors say if that behavior continues during the trial, the jury will have to be sequestered away from the media and their families and homes. A Washington jury wouldn't have to undergo the same extreme lifestyle change. Prosecutors say the alleged crimes took place in the nation's capital, where they claim that the false financial disclosure forms were created, reviewed, and signed, and that, quote, a substantial portion of Stevens' scheme to conceal occurred in or around the District of Columbia. The prosecution says some of its witnesses are already in the Washington area, and while most of the witnesses do live in Alaska, there's no proof the distance will prevent them from appearing, and the government will pay their travel expenses. Prosecutors also argue that there's no need to move the case closer to the Girdwood house, thanks to more than 1,000 high-resolution photos. They say that for all practical purposes, Washington, D.C. is Stevens' home. His wife works in the area, and the couple owns a local residence, so staying in Washington for the duration of the trial won't be a hardship on the senator. The request for a venue change brings up another question. Which judge will preside over the case? The prosecution notes that all 3 active U.S. district judges in Alaska were confirmed by the U.S. Senate during Stevens' years of service. They say it's possible the judges will have to recuse themselves. But Stevens' lawyers say that's no problem. They propose that the current Washington-based judge, Emmett Sullivan, travel north with the trial. Judge Sullivan will make his decision about moving the case to Alaska at a hearing next week on August 20th. In Washington, D.C., I'm Libby Casey.
The Sitka Mountain Rescue Squad has had 4 missions in the last 5 days. The most recent was recovery of the victims from a plane crash on Sunday night. And as KCAW's Bonnie Sue Hitchcock reports, it's a big week for missing aircraft in other parts of the state as well.
The 2 men killed in a plane crash Sunday evening on Baranoff Island have been identified as pilot Harold Joseph Gaines, age 83, of Marietta, Georgia. His passenger was Cy Mymudes, age 73, of Decatur, Georgia. Megan Peters, spokesperson for the Department of Public Safety, says it was an all-day effort to recover the 2 men from the crash site on a hillside in Peril Straits, 20 miles north of Sitka.
It was 550 feet above sea level. The Coast Guard flew a helicopter with a few members of the Sitka Mountain Rescue Team and lowered them in by a cable harness. The rescue members then cleared an area to make it easier for the rest of the people to be lowered into the area. A total of 7 mountain rescue people and Sergeant Dobson with the Alaska State Troopers went out to do the recovery effort.
The 2 men died from injuries sustained in the crash. Peter says while the cause of the accident is still under investigation, preliminary reports point to a possible fuel shortage. Dispatch reports confirm that emergency personnel in Sitka knew the plane was low on fuel, and emergency vehicles, including ambulances, were standing by at the Sitka airport when the plane lost radio contact with the FAA. Peter says searches are still underway for 2 other planes, one on the Kenai Peninsula and a small aircraft near Juneau with 2 experienced pilots on board. That plane has been missing since Saturday when it failed to return from Young Lake.
At this time, there's been no sign of the men or the aircraft. And so we know a general area that they were in when they went missing, but still it's a large area and it's a heavily wooded area. It makes it very difficult to go in and easily spot an aircraft or a person from the air. And so we are putting in the ground searchers to see if we'll get lucky and stumble upon them.
Peter says weather has hampered search efforts, but it is a full-scale operation. The U.S. Coast Guard, the Civil Air Patrol, the Alaska Army National Guard, and Juneau Mountain Rescue have all been assisting in the search, although they were grounded Tuesday morning due to fog. Peter says there are also numerous volunteers standing by as backup.
It's one of the things that it makes Alaska really a small community is when it comes to people missing, so many organizations and so many volunteer groups come together and do what needs to be done to bring people home.
The only information about a missing aircraft on the Kenai Peninsula was from a cell call Saturday night. But Peter says details provided by the caller were sketchy, and she says there is no way to trace the call or even define a search area in which to begin a rescue effort.
In this case, the caller said that he was at the Lost Lake area. There's more than one Lost Lake on the Kenai Peninsula. And if he is disoriented and in shock, I mean, he could just be thinking of the trip he took a couple days ago instead of the trip he took that one day. And so we have no real search area except for the entire Kenai Peninsula.
If anyone has information of overdue aircraft on the Kenai Peninsula, they are urged to contact troopers in Soldotna. Peter says this is sometimes the only way to narrow a search, which is why trip plans are so essential. She says even the smallest details, like what color a plane is, can make all the difference in finding a missing aircraft. But she also stresses this is a wake-up call and a reminder that when people are going out in rugged terrain, on boats or on planes, to remember the basics.
Do I have my life jackets in my boat? Do I have a first aid kit in my airplane? Does my ELT have batteries? Does my GPS have batteries? Do I have spare batteries for my GPS? Do I have something that I can communicate to people with? Hopefully, you'll never have to use them. But if you're in that situation where you do need help, it's best that you have all the tools possible to keep yourself safe and to let people know where you are.
In Sitka, I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
The slate of early entries for next winter's running of the Yukon Quest is already making for a competitive race. 22 teams signed up this past Saturday to run the 1,000-mile International Sled Dog Race. Quest Canadian director Stephen Reynolds says 13 veterans and 9 rookies took advantage of the early sign-up opportunity. Reynolds says the field includes the Quest's 4-time defending champion as well as a 4-time Iditarod winner.
Lance Mackey said years ago that he wants 5 in a row. He's signed up. Another name that people recognize, but not necessarily with Yukon Quest yet, is Martin Boozer. Martin signed up to run his first Yukon Quest, so he may well be the first Iditarod champion to be a Yukon Quest rookie.
Reynolds says early sign-up numbers are the highest in the 7 years he's worked on the race. Rough trail conditions on the Alaska portion of the race last year have prompted a change. The Quest recently announced the creation of an Alaska side trail coordinator position. Quest veteran and past champion John Schandelmeyer of Paxson will fill the post. The portion of the Quest Trail that runs through the Yukon Territory is set by the Canadian military, but the Alaska side depends on the efforts of local volunteers. Reynolds says Schandelmeyer will help assure trail breakers get the support they need.
I think that is going to make a substantial difference in the way we work with our volunteers in the communities. John is absolutely dedicated to working with our local trail breakers throughout Alaska in Two Rivers, in Eagle, in Circle, and in Central to make the changes necessary to make the Yukon Quest a professional sled dog race across all 1,000 miles.
Reynolds says the budget is still in the works, but that there will be more money to cover trail breaking costs, including fuel for volunteers who will again be counted on to do most of the work.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the State of Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Information about the state's predator management program is available on the web at wildlife.alaska.gov.
An ice-free Arctic will help shellfish as well as cargo ships travel across the top of the world. Clams and snails from the Bering Sea could even invade the North Atlantic. That's according to a paper published last week in the journal Science. Peter Rupnarine of the California Academy of Sciences and his co-authors looked at the fossil record of snails, mussels, and other mollusks. He says global warming is rapidly recreating conditions that haven't been seen in the Arctic Ocean for millions of years.
The last time that the Arctic
was reasonably warm and ice-free, which was about 3 million years ago, we had this dramatic movement of species from the North Pacific into the Arctic Ocean and on into the North Atlantic.
He says the migration across the Arctic Ocean only went one way, in part because mollusks in the Bering Sea are bigger and tougher than their Atlantic counterparts. He says 77 mollusk species could begin crossing the Arctic in just 10 or 20 years. The authors say underwater invasions rarely result in outright extinction of species, but they can severely disrupt life below and above the water. The impacts to commercial fisheries are unknown. A group of biologists searching for ice worms last week on the lower glaciers of Denali National Park came back empty-handed. Dan Shane of Rutgers University led the quest with APU's Roman Dial. On their 10-day grueling expedition, they traversed several glaciers, hiked over high passes, suffered crevasse falls, and bushwhacked through dense brush. Shane says, starting out, he was a bit skeptical the worms could exist in Denali.
Temperature of the Alaska Range glaciers is really cold in the winter. And our collective work suggests that ice worms can only live on the coastal glaciers. If the worms are there, they are very, very patchy. But probably the worms are not there right now. And I can't really say with any certainty whether the worms have ever been there.
And how extensive or exhaustive was your search? How much area did you cover?
I think we've done the most extensive search of the area ever. We covered more than 150 miles of glaciers, 12 different glaciers, all in the region that have been reported to have worms, but we didn't find them. So we're sort of forced to conclude now that they're probably not there. It's possible that they used to be there, and the worms have fallen victim of climate change because the glaciers have receded pretty dramatically, and it's possible that the worms were forced to higher elevations where, paradoxically, it became too cold for them. You know, even though the climate is warming, it became too cold for them because they were forced to higher elevations.
Why is it that you went looking at Denali in the first place for them, just because of anecdotal accounts of seeing them?
Well, it's a little more than anecdotal. We had collectively, as a group, Roman Dial, myself, and some other collaborators, have consistently heard stories, reliable stories, of worms being in the park. And they usually were centered around this place called Little Switzerland, and that's where we concentrated our efforts. So we hadn't heard this so many times from park rangers and climbers, then we wouldn't have gone there because we did not expect them to be there.
Why is it important? Why, for people trying to wrap their head around why an ice worm in one location or another matters, why does it matter?
Well, people are somewhat fascinated by ice worms. In fact, many Alaskans that I've met don't believe they exist. And when you're on a glacier and you're looking at this body of ice that looks very much like another planet. Not that I've been to another planet, but it sort of resembles a Martian landscape, but in an ice form. It's really a bizarre habitat, and it looks very sterile. So to have any type of life there, particularly a sophisticated form of life like a worm that's relatively large, is just quite amazing. So from that regard, it's interesting to understand how life can adapt to that extreme environment.
And so after this enormous effort, how disappointing was it to finish without settling the question of whether ice worms can exist in Denali?
It is disappointing. However, you know, once you do the best that you can, you're satisfied with that. And I'm satisfied at this point to say that the worms are probably not there right now. But there's still an opening, and we're going to offer a bounty. We're going to try to spread the word in the climbing community, offering a pretty substantial reward for anybody who can provide a specimen with geographic coordinates. And you know, with some luck, and if they're there, we will answer the question.
Dan Shane is a biology professor at Rutgers University in New Jersey. After a five-week, 5,000-mile road trip from Alaska to the Midwest, former Barrow commentator Earl Finkler, his wife Chris, and two panting Greenland Huskies, Avu and Nuna, reached their home in rural Medford, Wisconsin, earlier this month. Tonight, Finkler discusses the last part of the journey.
It was a trip we will long remember, with a strong focus on back roads and small towns. The Huskies learned about trees and mountains, and we learned that a slower pace of travel can be so relaxing. But we also learned to never say everything was going perfectly. I said that to Chris as we tent camped by a lovely lake in rural Ontario one night. The sun was just setting and the sky was full of color. Then the sun disappeared, and virtual armies of mosquitoes came flying in from all sides, like squadrons of P-51 fighters. Chris wound up with a swollen face, one eye closed, kind of an extreme allergic reaction. We drove into Thunder Bay and its hospital emergency room. An IV of antibiotics had a surprise impact on Chris. She fainted and fell to the floor, so a few more bruises. The next day, she went back to that emergency room and finally got well enough that we could continue our trip. 4 days later, we pulled into Medford and drove up to our new home. Big surprise, the neighbors had placed a welcome sign for us near the front door. They also planted flowers in the front and backyards. Beautiful. The next few days, a number of neighbors came over with homemade bakery, fresh raspberries, broccoli, beans, and other vegetables. So now, with Chris totally healthy and the dogs relatively cool in the shade, we're settling into small-town life in northern Wisconsin. Well, there still is the task of opening some 80 boxes that we mailed from Barrow and buying furniture so we don't have to sit and sleep on the floor. We also have to buy a television set before the start of the season for the Green Bay Packers and maybe in time for the Cubs World Series. In Medford, glad to be here, but still missing Barrow and Alaska, I'm Earl Finkler.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly in Kodiak, Angela Denning Barnes and Shane Iverson in Bethel, Bonnie Sue Hitchcock in Sitka, John Ryan in Juneau, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. Our intern is Eli Menneker. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Award-winning news to get you out of bed in the morning. The Alaska Morning News and the Alaska Economic Report bring you the information you need for the day.
Harvesting wild game is extremely important to many Alaskans, not only as a food source, but as a long-standing traditional practice. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game is committed to maintaining healthy caribou and moose populations. To learn more about the principles and guidelines behind predator management, visit wildlife.alaska.gov or contact your local fish and game office. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska, Department of Fish and Game. APRN will be providing special coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood. For sponsorship information, call 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.